This is BBC Radio 4 FM, where now it's time for our Book of the Week. Tracy Ann Oberman continues Leaving Before the Rains Come, Alexandra Fuller's follow-up to her internationally acclaimed memoir Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight. Once again charting her wildly unconventional upbringing in southern Africa. Today, as Alexandra prepares for her first camping trip with Charlie, she reflects on losing her religion and coming to worship her father, and what that might mean for future men in her life.
Lacking practice, most people report making poor decisions while under the influence of alcohol. But in our family, we made almost no major decisions sober. Looking back, I suspect it was because our choices were often so limited and required such outlandish courage to make that the only possible way to plunge ahead was to be drunk at the time of the decision and hungover at the time of the execution. We seemed always to be on the move, crossing another more or less unfriendly southern or central African border with everything we owned stuffed into one Land Rover. Mostly, though, I think my parents made major decisions drunk to avoid the possibility of ever doing anything either frugal or boring, which, of all possible sins, are the only two they consider truly deadly. "Boring is number one," Dad says. "Absolutely the worst possible sin." In 1977, when I was 8, and had first been introduced to the itchy terror of Sunday school in the Umtali Anglican Church Hall, I came home with the Ten Commandments painstakingly hand-drawn in bubble letters on poster board. "Show your parents," our Rhodesian Sunday school teacher had instructed, no doubt congratulating herself on subversively recruiting a dozen infiltrating little missionaries in one go. An enthusiastic, if slightly confused, convert, I considered my family could definitely use some holy guidance. Dad regarded my poster for a minute or two, eyebrows raised. "Some of the best chaps I know break all 10 of those before breakfast." He told me this with his guns stripped on newspaper at his feet, because in those war years, any time he was sitting down, he was also cleaning his gun. God, with all his wrath and constant references to war and patriarchal rules, seemed to show some very Rhodesian tendencies. But I was surprised that he had not been more specific with his Ten Commandments. "Thou shalt not kill, except terrorists and commies, surely. Also, thou shalt not cover thy neighbour's wife, except if she was Mum dancing on the bar at the club on Wednesday nights." Mum and Dad both would have been very offended if everyone had averted their adoring gaze. As for keeping the Sabbath holy and praying twice a day, that was all very well if you didn't have cattle to feed, a calving cow, or tobacco to reap. I concluded then there were two kinds of people. There were black and white people who hung their faith on heavenly matters. They were like my Sunday school teacher, with her mild stain of a moustache, her brimstone breath, and her pale, dappled dairy product skin. And then there were colourful people who had no particular regard for rules as delivered by either God or man, and who were like Mum and Dad and everyone else I knew, with their calloused hands and their lithe hips and barbed wire scratches on their arms. I had been born and bred of colourful people, but I had black and white leanings. Losing faith is not the same as losing belief, but it can break the fragile tether between a person and her innocence just the same. On the afternoon of January the 9th, 1978, my world fell to pieces, and out of the devastation that remained, I could never, ever again make anything whole. On that day, my sister Olivia drowned in a neighbour's pond. The sin of omission was mine. My eyes had turned from babysitting. My attention had been captured by the earthly wonders and temptations of a farm grocery store. My trustworthiness had been tested and found to be lacking. "It was one of those things, Bobo," Dad told me, trying to make it better. But I knew it wasn't a thing. It was a fault. Specifically, it was my fault. That night and for months afterward, my prayers were so urgent, so clear, so grief-soaked and guilt-ridden. I was a 9-year-old vessel of Old Testament awe and superstition. All I knew back then is that God could bring the dead back to life, so I conducted experiments. I held myself under bathwater, willing myself to take the breath that might resemble Olivia's last fatal inhalation of green duck water. I spent nights on the bare wooden floorboards of the dormitory, as I imagine monks and nuns must do. At last, I concluded that if God existed, he was not my personal saviour. He was, I thought, on the side of the contemporary mustachioed Bible thumpers, the genuinely black and white people like my Sunday school teacher, not the fake faithless believers like me. Then on the night of June 23rd, 1978, at the Emmanuel Mission School, 8 British missionaries and 4 of their children, ranging in age from 6 to 3 weeks old, were killed by liberation forces. Inevitably, the image of the dead missionary baby became conflated in my mind with the memory of Olivia's motionless corpse on the bed of our neighbour's spare room on the afternoon of her drowning. My already shaky belief vaporized, leaving nothing but a fear and a terrible sense of aloneness in its place. I came to the only possible logical conclusion. God could not exist. God was nowhere. And in the absence of God, I transferred his authority to the next highest visible logical power, my father. After all, like God, Dad's rules were absolute, capricious, and patriarchal. Like God, Dad could seem remote and mysterious, by turns withholding and munificent. Like with God, you could talk to Dad without the expectation of reply or favour, and even if nothing happened or the outcome was unfavourable, you could comfort yourself by arguing that he knew best. And, as the man of the house, and more important, the man with the FN rifle, he held in his gift the seeming power of life and death. I worshipped him. I had always thought it would be an impossibly tricky sideways manoeuvre to slip out of my father's jurisdiction and under the influence of some other calmer control without eddying out of my life altogether. But Charlie seemed the perfect escort for such a move. He was capable and unflappable, and didn't appear enthralled or impressed by my father's suicide mission of a deliberately disordered life. While Charlie had a degree in international business and liked to discuss global finance and economic theory, Dad seemed so bored by money. "You win some, you lose some," Dad always said, and didn't seem to mind which side of that equation he landed on. Then the strong arming to drink more than the sensible amount, a couple of beers, an aperitif, a glass of wine with supper, didn't impress Charlie at all. "Never trust anyone who doesn't drink," my mother said. But in our very first evening alone together, Charlie defied my parents' fears and offered me a kamikaze. "Vodka with lime," he explained. I said, "Sounds wonderful." So Charlie mixed 2 drinks and led me into the garden. "Nostrovir," he said. "Mud in your eye." Then I swallowed my drink the way my mother does, as if marauding barbarians are bearing down on her to steal it away from her parched lips. Charlie sipped his thoughtfully. The sun went down, and the temperature dropped. Charlie told me about Wyoming. It was winter for 7 months a year there, he said. Snow piled up to the eaves of his grandmother's cabin. And when summer came, it descended like panic, everything happening at once. 13.5 years after Olivia drowned, and 13 years after the massacre of those missionaries, after a lifetime of seeing tragedies of the sort that seemed both accidental and continual, drought, the genocide of the Ndebele people in Matabeleland, the beginning of the AIDS epidemic, my mind knew that tragedy and violence weren't mine alone, but my body hadn't stopped knowing panic. Charlie seemed to have none of my brokenness, whole and undamaged to the naked eye, Charlie's default was calm. Slightly concerned it might be a borrowed calm, I asked him if he was religious.
Not really.
His God, he said, was in mountains and rivers. His church was big sky and deep water. His religion was the wilderness. I too had lost my heart to the wilderness, but it was the dangerously lost heart of a lover, not of a believer. We left Lusaka the next morning just after dawn, and were launching our canoes below the Kariba Dam a few hours later. A pod of hippos snorted at us as we began our wobbling descent downstream. Charlie was unafraid, because he saw the hippos not as I did, as the most murderous of all African wildlife, but as fellow river dwellers. I saw the landscape around us tattooed with death, fraught with the possibility of unrecovered landmines and undetonated ordnance. Charlie, however, saw it as recreationally pristine and friendly. We pulled away from the hippos. The sun struck the water in burning silver threads and bounced back into our faces. By early afternoon, we'd made enough progress to justify beaching the canoes for something to eat. After lunch, Charlie decided to walk up a gully and
stretch our legs.
If it had been up to me, I'd have stuck close to the river, drunk another beer, slept in the shade. The midday sun was at its most intense, and the bush was at its most flat and unknowable this time of day. Still, I followed Charlie. "Mad dog's an Englishman," I said.
"What's that?"
Charlie said, turning back towards me. But before I could repeat myself, the foliage in front of us exploded, and an enraged elephant emerged, ears flapping, trunk raised, dust clouding at her feet. The dry season jessie bush clattered. It was a classic mock charge, but on the ground, facing her, it seemed undeniably serious to me. Charlie, who had read his guidebooks and therefore knew not to run, turned implacably to face her. I scurried up the nearest anthill. The elephant stopped short of full attack, tossed her ears at Charlie, and then retreated, her tail straight up in the air. I remember thinking, he's charmed. He's the Charlie Ross who walks away from an elephant charge. Which was silly, of course. The memories of my wedding are not unfortunate, although they are swimming and episodic because I had woken up with malaria.
That flash delirious look you have in all the wedding photos, Mum said. In retrospect, it was probably just a temperature of 105.
We exchanged vows. Charlie put a ring on my finger, and we were pronounced man and wife. Most vivid in my memory was the encounter with Dad's friend, the Polish father from the Catholic mission at Oldham Kuszy. He caught me by the shoulders just as I was making my way into the garden for the photographs.
"The first year is hard, and after that, it gets worse,"
he said, his mouth so close to my ear that I could smell the red dust-infused scent of his river-washed, sun-dried clothes. I laughed.
"No, really, it's true,"
he insisted.
"I should know. I've been married to God for 50 years.
Tracy Ann Oberman continues reading Leaving Before the Rains Come by Alexandra Fuller tomorrow. It was abridged by Richard Hamilton and produced by Justine Willett.
Hollywood's just, they're like a bunch of pigs in a trough.
The film industry, seen from the inside.
The movie divisions became smaller and smaller divisions within a large corporate conglomerate, and it became about earnings, not about making great films that you're passionate about.
The economic realities of filmmaking.
They didn't make the film, but it cost them a fairly eye-watering chunk of change.
An eye-watering chunk of change not to make it.
The Business of Film with Mark Kermode begins this Sunday at 1:30 and then available on the BBC Radio 4 website.